it's amazing. So this, you know, for me, it's my opinion on it, but I think that you'll get out of it what I get out of it, and it's truly some great experience, strength, and hope. And I would love to introduce Shay. He's our main speaker tonight, and if you could give him a warm welcome. And we also have a gift for Shay tonight.
My name is Shay Baird, and by the mercy of God and through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am a sober alcoholic.
Hi, Shay. We love you, Shay. Lots and lots and lots. And oh,
who are yourself? I love that. Love it. So when I walked in here tonight, somebody said to me, are you nervous? And I said, hell yeah. Of course I am. You know, I can't stand up here and say that one of my favorite things to do is stand up in front of a room full of people and speak, because I really don't like to do it. But I was told a long time ago that if I didn't, the chances would increase that I would lose my sobriety. I was told that it was an obligation that I had to Alcoholics Anonymous and to God Almighty to share my experience, strength, and hope with other alcoholics. And it was pointed out to me that that was our primary purpose, to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. On November 16th, 1950, Dr. Bob died. And that night, Bill W. spoke at a meeting. And one of the things he said in that talk was this: in Alcoholics Anonymous, we don't make speeches. We share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And that's kind of what I want to try to do tonight. And I want to try to do it the way the Big Book tells me to, by sharing a little bit about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. I was obsessing about this all day. When I first got sober, and where I got sober up in Boston, and is this mic all right? I mean, I haven't got a clue. I'm just hearing this echo here. So, there were a lot more speaker meetings back then, very, very few discussion meetings. So I used to do this a lot, because one group would carry its message out to another group, and then that group would come back and do a commitment for that group, and everybody would get to hear a little bit about how some drunks get sober after they pretty much ruined their lives. And I moved out here about 14 years ago, and this is probably only about the fifth time I've spoken at a stand-up meeting. And the last time I did was down in Artesia. And I had spent that whole day kind of obsessing about, well, I should say this and I should say that. You know, maybe I'll say this and maybe I'll say that. Well, I get down there and I get up behind the podium, and I couldn't put two thoughts together if they were magnets. You know, so for the next half hour, people sat there and listened to me babble, and at the end of that half hour, I didn't have a clue about anything I'd said. I don't think anybody else in the room did either, and all I could think of is, I don't want to see Artesia again for a long time, you know? It's just an incredible blessing to be here, you know, and I really want to, first of all, offer my congratulations and my thanks to the people who worked so hard to put this together. You really deserve that. You know, yeah, I'm sitting here looking at, I'm standing here looking at all these lights. See, that's, I'm a drunk. I don't know if I'm sitting or standing. I'm standing here looking at all these lights that are kind of blinding me, so I can't see any of you except as a few blurs. And I'm thinking, you know, if this were a theater and this were one of the auditions for America's Got Sobriety, These people would deserve to come up here and really take a bow and get some real big awards from the judges, because they're the hope of Alcoholics Anonymous, just like you are in my heart. You know, when I look in the mirror today, I look and say, who the hell are you? Yeah, it wasn't long ago you were 34 years old. What happened? What happened was life, and I got to enjoy most of it because of sobriety. And that was certainly not always the case with me. You know, I guess in sharing experience, strength, and hope, the only thing I know how to do here is tell you my story and hope that perhaps somebody can identify with a little bit of what happened to me. Because I was told to do that when I came here. I'm an alcoholic. I'd spent my whole life looking at why I was different and why you were different. And they told me here I had to learn to look to identify, to learn to identify, to look for similarities, and to listen to what people were saying, and maybe I'd find out that I wasn't quite as unique as I seemed to think I was. And I wasn't, and I used to think I was. I was affected by alcoholism long before I took my first drink. I can honestly stand here in front of you tonight and say that there's never been a single day since I was born that my life hasn't been touched by alcoholism in one way or another. I was born into an alcoholic family, like so many of the people that I've heard speak over the years. And although I was never physically abused, there was certainly a lot of mental and emotional abuse living in a family like that, because it goes along with alcoholism. And I don't know, you know, by the time I was 5 years old, I'd heard and seen things that I truly believe no human being should ever see, let alone any child. And there were just so many broken promises and the violence that was there. You know, one of my earliest memories, and I guess some things dig so deeply into a person's heart that they stay with them forever. And you know, I was about 5 years old. My aunt used to come and rescue me from the house. She'd get me away from them for a while, do things like take me to circuses and things like that. And at one point, coming back from a circus, I had she give me a little toy sword. And see, by the time I was five, my bedroom was way in the back of the house. But I knew if my father wasn't home from work by 5 o'clock, there was going to be trouble. And when I'd go to sleep at night, way from the back of the house, when that key went in the door, I'd hear it, and I'd wake up, and I was afraid. And see, I was afraid most of my life, but it started back then. Because I knew what was coming. I knew the screaming. I knew the beatings. I knew those things were going to happen, and I knew there was nothing I could do about it. And I'd lay in bed, hugging a teddy bear with one arm and holding that sword for another. I know it sounds crazy today, but it was just a little boy who didn't know what to do, who didn't understand the horror that was going on in that house. And somewhere, at a very early age, my heart broke. By the time I was 14, I had pretty much withdrawn into myself. I became a reader. I stopped hanging out with the other kids in the neighborhood. I'd spend a lot of time on the porch. I'd hide in books. I'd pretend that my life was in that book and not the reality of what it was. And by the time I was 16, my mind had become so broken, I guess. I don't know if that's the right word or not. But I used to think, when he comes home tonight, just one little push down the stairs and it would all end. Nobody'd know, just push. Well, I never did anything like that, but it was in my heart, it was in my mind, and I didn't understand then how terrible alcoholism is as a family disease. I used to always think that meant, you know, if you had a parent that was alcoholic and you were alcoholic. What I didn't understand was how other people get sick around the person who did the drinking, how mentally, emotionally, and spiritually sick everyone can become. And I was sick. And at 16 years of age, I did something that I never should have done. No one in their right mind, seeing what I'd seen growing up, should have ever taken a drink. But at 16, I did. I had met some guys from the next town over. I grew up in South Boston. It's a tough, blue-collar, heavy-drinking Irish Catholic community. If you lived there, your chances of when you grew up were probably you were going to end up a priest, a cop, or a politician, and definitely you were most likely going to end up a drunk. I made the fourth. The first three didn't happen, but the fourth one did. But I met these other guys, and I don't remember how, where, or anything else, just that I started hanging out with them. And one night they said, you know, we got a jug. You want to go down by the tracks and share it with us? And I said, yeah, and I did. And I remember staring at that bottle and thinking, you know, this is the crap that makes my father as sick as he gets. Then I didn't understand that he was sick. I thought he was just bad. Today I understand that wasn't the case. He had the same disease that I have, and it affected him in a lot of the same ways it affected me. But we knocked off that bottle of stolen vodka. I was already a thief, you know. It was a lot different back then. That was, I don't know, 1956, 57, something like that. I know I don't look it, but I'm 74. No comments. Thank you. I like that. I can't see who it is, but thank you. You know, by the time about five or six of us had knocked off that fifth of vodka, I'd fallen in love. For the first time in my life, I felt the way that I really wanted to feel. It was the most amazing thing. Nothing bothered me. Everything was wonderful. The world looked brighter. I didn't care what was happening at home. It wasn't my problem anymore. And until the time I was 34, I chased that feeling. I never got it again. Never once. Not one time. You know, and it was that endless, hopeless quest of the alcoholic. And it almost killed me. I knew nothing about alcoholism. I just knew that my father was a drunk. I knew that once, back in, I don't know, 1947 or so, a couple of guys had showed up at our house, and I remember asking my mother, who happened to be a control freak with everything, you know. I guess that happens in alcoholic families, you know. Somebody has to try to make sense out of it and control everything. And I remember she told me he was going to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I said, what the hell is that? You know, probably that's not exactly the way I put it at seven, but she said, you know, it's a place where people like your father can go and get well. Well, he went to that one meeting, he came home, and he got drunk, and he never went back. And that was the last I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time, because when I started drinking, that the immediate thing, that the denial was there. It was there right away. I will never be like him. And I wasn't. I was like me. And it was not a pretty sight. I was not a pretty drunk. You know, when I look at it today, I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was 16 years old. That first night that I drank, when it felt so wonderful, the obsession set in right away. I couldn't wait for the next weekend. Let's go get drunk and get in trouble. Let's get down to the dance at the school and cause trouble. It's the way we were when we drank. And it was like that for every weekend. The problem was the second weekend. Second time I drank, I became a blackout drinker. I remember being down by the railroad tracks. I remember having a whole bunch of this crap that they used to sell out in Boston. It was called Old India Ale and Beer. And that stuff would rip your head off, guaranteed. And the next thing I knew, it was Sunday morning, and I was in my house, and nobody was happy. Well, it turns out that how I got home that night was these guys who were just as drunk as I was drove me home, brought me in the house, threw me on the living room floor. Now, the first thing that hit me the next morning was they drove me home. None of us had a car. You know, so somebody was missing a car, and I was missing the whole night. Now, I think most people that, you know, would be social drinkers, that would really scare them. Alcohol-induced amnesia. I can't remember what I did last night. I came home in a car that had to be stolen. I went out and drank that next night. thought it was funny, and it wasn't funny. You know, it was the beginning of the destruction of a life through drinking. And it went on for a long time. At 18, I wanted to get out of that house so badly. So I joined the service. And there's a long story behind that, and it's a crazy story. I just wanted to be out of the house. I knew I couldn't go to college because there was no money for that. You know, we were lucky if there was enough money after the booze was bought to put food on the table. There always was. It was adequate, but, you know, the primary focus was by the booze. And when I was a little kid, I had polio. You probably noticed I had a little trouble getting up these stairs. I got this thing now called post-polio syndrome, a little bit of it, and my legs aren't so good anymore. But I'd always wanted to join the Marine Corps. So at 17, I asked my parents if they'd sign the papers, and they said, sure. And this Marine came over, and they signed the papers. And without telling me, the next day, you know, I thought, here's my dream coming true. And without telling me, the next day, they went down, and they rescinded their permission. They said, no, we're not going to let you do it. You have to wait until you're 18 to finish school. And my house was always one of those, do as I say, not as I do. And I guess in a lot of ways I lived my life that way too for a long time. But anyway, come the end of high school, I went down, tried to join the Marines, made the mistake of telling them I had polio, and they said, we won't take you, come back. And then the recruiter said, come back in 6 months. Don't tell them about the polio. Thought that sounds good to me. You know, lying, what's a big deal about that? Yeah, I grew up with lies, so it seemed pretty normal to me. Anyway, I went back down. The Marine recruiter wasn't there. The Air Force recruiter came out and said, why don't you sit in my office? And about 20 minutes later, I was in the damn Air Force. Yeah. And that was just wonderful. And, you know, honestly, I can stand here today and say I'm glad it worked out that way. Because after they sent me to school for a few things, at the age of 18, they sent me to Germany for 3 years. And it was like, wow, I can drink without having to worry about it. I can drink legally here. And let me tell you, I did. How I ever survived 3 years in Germany and got out of the Air Force with an honorable discharge is absolutely beyond me. I mean, these people gave me an extremely high security clearance, very high security clearance. And when I was there, it was a bad time there. It was when they were building the wall in Berlin. And I think I was probably drunk every time I was there. That's all that mattered, you know. Somehow I managed to do my job. I managed to get through it. But every waking moment, I'd be out drinking, and that's how my life became. People would say to me, you drink too much. I'd say, nah, no, 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 no. Not me. You're imagining it. And the truth was, I drank way too much, too often, at any occasion. And I didn't know anything about the obsession with alcohol. You know, it was all I wanted to do. I just wanted to drink and party. And man, I'll tell you, you know, it was only 14 years after the end of the Second World War, and there weren't a whole lot of men left in Germany, but there were an awful lot of really beautiful women. And I thought, between their beer and their women, I have most definitely gone to paradise. Yeah. However, after they got to know me for a while, they thought they had probably gone to the other side of paradise. You know, it was, you know what? Why don't you just go away? You know, you say a lot of things that you don't live up to. And that was part of my alcoholism. I'd say an awful lot of things that I couldn't live up to. Made a lot of promises and broke them the same way it had been done to me, and I know I was doing it to other people. And by the time I get back from Germany, I had no money. Spent every dime that I had drinking and, you know, so what do? I moved back into the crazy house with my parents and expected somehow it would be better because I was older. The difference was, now I'm there with a controlling mother, a drunk father, and I'm a drunk. So if anything, you know, it became this Irish battleship. Everything was, there was always fighting going on over one thing or another. Nobody agreed with anything, and it was all crazy. I knew nothing about alcoholism as a disease. I knew nothing about it being progressive. But I know about a year after I got out of the service, when I was 22 years old, I got an incredible break in life. I got a job at Harvard University. It didn't pay a lot of money, but it had incredible benefits, and one of those benefits was a free Harvard education. 2 years later, I was out, fired, because I was drunk on the job more often than not, and they knew it. For a while, I had done a pretty good job of concealing my drinking, I guess, through the military. I mean, people knew, but I could still hide it. I could still function. But it was becoming more and more obvious. You know, I was at that point, at probably by the age of 24, that I needed that morning drink. I had the shakes. I was sick. All I could think about was, you know, that booze had become the priority. Everything else had to center around my drinking. The drinking came first. And they caught on to this. I mean, this is Harvard University. They're not exactly stupid there, you know. And even if they were, you know, you could smell me coming a mile away. And it didn't take a lot of intelligence to figure out that I had a drinking problem. It's just that I lacked the intelligence to figure it out myself because of a thing called denial. And I was told in Alcoholics Anonymous later on that progression and denial are the two primary symptoms of alcoholism. And I believe that. You know, I really didn't see it in myself. I knew I drank too much, but I'd already get into the blame game. You know, if you live the way I did, you'd drink too. If you had the hard luck I had, you'd drink too. You're responsible for my drinking, that's responsible for my drinking. Someplace else, you know, somebody blew up a bomb in East Indochina, or that's responsible for my drinking. It was everything but me, and it was never me. And I've never met an honest alcoholic yet in AA who hasn't said the same thing, that they could always find somebody to point the finger at, some person, place, or thing to point their finger at, and it will say, that's the cause for my drinking, but it was never a finger that pointed inward. Now, I believe alcoholism is like a human eye. It can see out, but it doesn't see in. And I just never knew, and I got sicker and sicker. By the time I was 27 years old, I was on Skid Row. You know, when I first came back from Germany, when I had the job at Harvard, this is going to sound crazy, especially looking at me these days, but I also got a job as a model. I was a male fashion model for a while. And yeah, well, see, that's what I thought too. I was pretty in love with myself, you know. I was like, wow, look at me. Yeah. I tell you what, that career didn't last very long because... Like everything else, I always had to have a couple of drinks just to warm me up, to get me going, you know. And, well, before a fashion show one night, I had more than a couple of drinks. And so it came time to go out in the catwalk, and I went out in the catwalk, and I walked down the catwalk and walked right off the end of the damn thing and fell in this lady's lap. Okay? Guess what happened? I never modeled again, you know. There was a change that other people noticed that I didn't. You know, the guy who, when he came home from Germany, always wore three-piece European cut suits, you know, everything had a match. Now I was into combat boots, jeans, and a pea coat. And I was drinking in places that not long before I wouldn't have walked. I would have crossed the street instead of walked beside them. You know, I mean, to call them buckets of blood would be to put it mildly. And it just kept getting worse and worse and worse until, you know, I'd sit in these joints and I'd look down the bar and I'd see some guy or some girl, equal opportunity disease, and they'd have their head down in the bar, passed out, sound asleep, snoring, peeing themselves, whatever they were doing. And I used to sit there and judge them and say, you know what, if I ever get that bad, I'd quit. Well, then came the night when I found myself picking my head up off the bar. And then I began to find myself doing little things like, well, I'm not going to go into that, but there were ways that I got money. You know, one of them was to just watch these people who'd leave their change on the bar. They'd go to the men's room, the ladies' room, and Shea'd be out the door with their money and heading for the next bar. I used to hunt out the lonely-looking older ladies. Yeah. And I'd try to give them what they wanted as long as they gave me what I wanted. You know, it's called being a hooker, you know, and that's what I became, you know. But I didn't see it that way. I was just their companion, you know. It was perfectly fine. And, you know, eventually even that went away, and I found myself drinking in these places where, you know, they were just Skid Row bars. I don't even know how to describe them. And you know, I'd find myself drinking in alleyways, and I get down to drinking all this wonderful stuff. You know, I don't know if it's still around anymore, but I used to drink a lot of Mad Dog 2020. Yeah, great stuff. There was another one called Silver Satin. It was a Muscatel. That was really good. It was 35 cents a pint. And yeah, that was one. Yeah, it was good stuff, all right. You know. And then there was my favorite, Thunderbird. You know, there used to be a little thing about that. You know, what's the word, Thunderbird? What's the price? 30 twice. You know, 60 cent a pint wine. And I'll be honest with you, by the end of my drinking, I'd gotten class. I was drinking Italian wine. It was called Paisano. It was a Chianti that came in a gallon bottle, and it was $2 a gallon. Yeah, wonderful stuff. You know, when I'd throw up in the morning, I didn't know if it was blood or wine, so it would be perfectly all right. You know, and I really don't mean to make light of this, because inside, my soul was a snake pit. I don't have to probably tell you what it's like, you know, when you wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning and you're not quite sure where you are or what you've done, but your heart's pounding and the sweat is pouring off you, and there's a terrible fear that every second you're going to die, and everything in you wants another drink, and everything in you is disgusted at the fact that you want another drink, and that's how I lived. Today, in my life today, if I woke up in the morning feeling the way that I used to feel just about every morning, I would call an ambulance and go to the emergency room. But my emergency room then was to somehow find another drink. And I knew all the after-hours joints. I knew all the places I could go to and knock on the back door at 5 o'clock in the morning and get what I needed to fix me, which happened to be the same thing that I'd used the night before to make me sick. And I was caught in that awful cycle of drinking where I had to drink what made me sick to get well enough to drink more of what made me sick. And it went on and on and on and on and on, and I wanted to die. Inside myself, I wanted to die. In 1965, I found myself at an AA meeting. And I sat and I listened to these men and women speak. In those days, there were a lot more men in AA than women. There weren't nearly as many women as there are now. And I think one of the wonderful things is that it's been opened up so much for people. And I thought to myself, you know, these people make a lot of sense. I'm glad they found this program. They really need it. Okay, so come the end of the meeting, I always tried to be a polite person. I really did, even when I was on the skids. You know, I always tried. It didn't always work very well, but I tried. You know, so I went and thanked them all, and they said, well, keep coming, you know. And they all went out and got in their cars and went home. I walked out the door, walked across the courtyard and into the building where my bed was in the psychiatric hospital I was locked up in, and I thought they were crazy and I was all right. I was so sick that I thought getting locked up in mental institutions was a vacation. That was a good hunting ground because there were sick ladies there that I could get over on. That's how twisted I was. It says in the book that the final result of untreated alcoholism are jails, institutions, and death. Well, I've been in jails, locked up overnight for things like that, but, you know, I never did any time. But the thing was, I ended up in a lot of institutions, and most of them were state mental hospitals. They kept me in one of these places for, I don't know what it was, 2.5, 3 months one time. And they let me go, and I got on a bus, and I ended up down in Harvard Square. By the way, just as a little aside, on one of the gates into Harvard, there are these wrought iron gates, and on one of them there's a word engraved, and the word is Latin, and the word is veritas, and the word is truth. Veritas is truth. I used to walk by that every day, and I could never see the truth in myself. I could never see what I was. They let me out of that psych hospital. I got to Harvard Square. And Bill tells a story like this, too. And I needed to find a restroom. Now, there's plenty of things in Harvard Square, plenty of places, restaurants, department stores, but I went into a bar. And it was just to use the restroom. Well, the next morning I was back in that state mental hospital, strapped down to a bed. I didn't know that I didn't have to live that way. I didn't know that I didn't have to live with that snake inside of me, that twisted, awful feeling. And I heard those people at that meeting say that, and I didn't want what they had. See, I'd reached that point where I didn't want to be a drunk anymore. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I was an alcoholic. What I couldn't accept was that I was powerless. I wouldn't accept that. How is something like booze going to be stronger than me? I was, you know, I had this crazy thought that if I just drank long enough, somehow I'd learn to drink like a normal person. How insane is that, you know? I'm in jail cells, I'm on Skid Row. I used to walk around smelling something, and it was disgusting, and I used to always be looking around thinking, what the hell is that? It was me. It was the booze coming out of my pores. And yet I still thought I could find a way to control this. And never once in my life had I ever controlled my drinking. It had controlled me right from the beginning. There were times early on in my drinking where, could I stop for a while? Sure I could, but I couldn't stay stopped. And when I went back, it was just like it says in the book. It always got worse, never better. Never once did it ever get better. And I'd look and I'd see when there were still people around me, I'd see the pain in their eyes, and I'd know I put it there, and that crushed me, and the only way I knew how to get away from that pain was to drink more. My life was totally owned by alcohol. And I was completely insane, and I had no idea that I was. I just thought I was a guy who was down on his luck because nobody understood me. I used to think nobody knew that I was an alcoholic. My God, it was like hanging a sign around my neck that said alcoholic on it and walking around. Everybody knew but me. And I left an awful trail of broken hearts and hurt people behind me. Sometimes at meetings I hear people say, well, you know, I never hurt anybody as bad as I hurt myself. Maybe that's true for them. But when I hear them say that, I always think to myself, how do you know how badly you hurt somebody else? Tonight, all these years later, I have no idea how much damage I might have done to people. I have no idea whatsoever. And all I've ever been able to do through the years is to try to change my way of life. And the only thing that ever allowed me to do that was the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Believe me when I tell you, when the pain got bad out there, there reached a point in my life when, well, I was bouncing in and out of here after that first meeting. I had several sobriety dates. You know, I was 65, then 67, another one in 69. And the problem was I was coming to meetings and I wasn't doing a damn thing. I thought that just coming to meetings and sitting here somehow I was going to be struck magically sober, and it didn't work. I just kept getting drunk. So I tried everything. You know, psychiatry, guruism. I'd been dumped, confessed, blessed, cursed, condemned, told I was a sinner, told I was hopeless, told I was helpless. I just kept getting drunk. And everybody said, see, we told you. But you know, something had happened at that first meeting. And I wasn't aware of it for quite a long time. There was a seed that was planted. I don't know if I heard the words, but I saw the people, they shared their stories, and they said to me, there is a solution, and we know what it is, if you want it, and if you're willing to go to any length to get it. And I wasn't willing to go to any length to get it. I wanted it my way. I'm a drunk. I want everything my way. I had sober for a while in late 1971, the year Bill died. And I think I stayed sober in the program for 9 months, but as usual, I really wasn't doing anything except going to meetings. And, you know, I'm not a dumb guy. I never was. I read the book. I memorized half of it. I could walk into meetings and quote it all over the place. And I couldn't live it. Couldn't live it. Wasn't willing to do the work. So on Sunday morning in early, I guess it was May or June of 1972, I woke up. And I was planning on calling somebody from the program that day to see what they were doing. But when I woke up, I had this sudden thought that said, you know what, one wouldn't hurt. It's a nice day, go have one. Besides, nobody will know. You can control it now, you've got 9 months. Oh, I'd had 9 months before, 3 months here, 4 months there. But my mind, you know, nothing in this entire world, nothing or anybody has ever lied to me more than my own mind does. And I listened. I just go have one. There used to be a part of Boston called the Combat Zone. Most people that walk or drive miles out of the way did not even go through it. But that was where I drank all the time. It was, you know, just this wild life, see? One of the things, there were three things in life I always loved. I loved fast cars, honky-tonk bars, and honky-tonk women. I still love fast cars and honky-tonk women. It doesn't do me any good anymore, but, you know, I still love it. Anyway, I went down right back to this joint called Edwards Western Playhouse, and I had my one beer, and my whole plan was, well, I'll just have one, maybe two, but no more than that. And tomorrow I'll go back to AA and nobody will know. The deceitfulness, the dishonesty of the alcoholic was right there in me again because I hadn't done anything to get rid of it. Well, the plan didn't quite work out. I stayed drunk for 3 solid years. I was on a 3-year drunk. And the only time I wasn't drinking was when I was too damn sick to get off of whatever floor or street corner I might have been on. And that 3 years taught me the true meaning of powerlessness. Everything in me wanted to come back to AA, everything. I used to go to where meetings were. And in those days, most of the meetings up there were 8:30 to 10 o'clock at night. And I couldn't get through the door. I'd hide out in the parking lot because I was so ashamed I didn't want anybody to see me. But I could never get that door open. I know you want to get to the pool, so I'm going to wrap this up pretty quick. But something did happen. When I got so sick that I reached that point in the book where I could no longer imagine life with or without alcohol, when death had become an acceptable alternative to living my life the way I was living it, I got on my knees one morning, very sick, and I took the first 3 steps. See, I'm one of those people that believes you can do the first 3 steps in about 30 seconds. It's right there in the book, you know. Do you believe that you're an alcoholic and your life is unmanageable? Do you believe that probably no human power could relieve your alcoholism? And do you believe that God could? And what if he was sought? And the next sentence in the book says, being convinced we were at step 3. And what is step 3 but to get on my knees and turn the care of my life and my will over to God? It doesn't take long. It doesn't take a lot of writing. It doesn't take a lot of intellectual understanding. What it took was action. And I did it, and something happened, and I didn't know what had happened. The sick young man that had knelt down that day and done those steps was a young man who couldn't stop drinking even when he wanted to. And the man who stood up was a man who didn't drink. He didn't have to drink even when he wanted to. And I didn't know that. I drank for 2 more days. And a very strange thing happened. I couldn't get drunk. It was like drinking water. It had no effect whatsoever. And I found myself back in that Edwards Weston Playhouse, and it was about 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night, and I was pretty broke. And for some reason, I got off a bar stool, and I walked to the corner where there was an old phone booth, and I went in there, and I put a dime in the phone, and I called the operator, and I said, "Can you help me? I think I'm dying." And she said to me, I'll never forget this. She said, "Are you having a heart attack?" And I said to her, "No, ma'am, I'm drinking myself to death." And I will never forget what she said to me. She said, "You hang in there, baby. I'll take care of you." Now, if she wasn't in this AA, I'll eat my shirt. You know, who would say that, you know? "Hang in there, baby. I'll take care of you." And she said, "Just stay on the line." And I said, "You know, I don't have any money. I can't put anything else on the phone." She said, "Don't worry about it. I won't cut you off." She said, "But I'm going to make some phone calls, and I'm going to get you some help." And she did. And to this day, I could kneel down in gratitude for that person whose name I didn't know, whose face I'd never seen. I can only assume she was in AA. "You hang in there, baby. I'll get you some help." Yeah, how much did it take? And I went into a detox. There weren't any rehabs back then. There were a couple, but they were not for people like me. I went into this 5-day detox. And I've never had to take a drink since then, or a substitute. Never had to. And if that's not a miracle, I don't know what is. You know, when I look around here, I look at a whole bunch of people that surer than hell should understand what the miraculous is. I see that when I go into any AA meeting. And those first months of sobriety were not anything easy. I was one really sick person. But the one thing I did was I kept going to meetings, and I kept hearing things that people were saying to me. And they were saying things like, "You know what? You're not a piece of junk. God doesn't create junk, and you're not his first piece. And your life isn't a mistake. God doesn't make mistakes, and you're not his first one." And they said to me, "You're sick. You're not bad. Yeah, maybe you have a disease that makes you do bad things, but you're not a bad person. You're a sick person. And diseases happen to people, not because of them, and you can get well, and we have the solution, and it's right there in the book. Learn to read it. Learn to talk to people. Learn to trust us a little bit." And I thought, yeah, right. You want something from me. Yeah, like I had anything to give anybody, you know. They did want something from me. They wanted the opportunity to help me so they could stay sober, and I learned about that as time went on. I believe in a very basic and simple AA. I can get pretty controversial. There aren't any rules in AA, I'm sorry. You know, there are a lot of rule makers, but they have absolutely no authority or power to enforce those rules. There are no rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I came here, people told me that, and I thought, Mother of God, this can't be right. You know, for the first time in my life, people aren't going to be telling me what to do. They're going to let me make my own decisions, and that was scary. And they said, yeah, we'll help you with them, but you're the one who's going to have to make your own decisions. And one of the things that struck me so much when I first came into AA was a very simple thing. They were so organized. My life was frenetic, chaotic, broken, painful, and these people were organized. I'd walk in, the meeting would start on time, it'd end on time. And they'd tell you right now, you know, if you're going to run this meeting over, don't do it because you don't have anything to say that's important, that's that important that somebody else can't say too. You're not unique. And I thought, yes, I am. And they said, no, you're not. And I'd say things like, well, you know, I got to figure out why I'm an alcoholic. And they'd say, you know what? If you're in a swamp and you're up to your butt in alligators, you don't have to figure out how you got in there. You got to figure out how to get out, and that's what we're here to help you do. You're up to your butt in alligators. And they were right. And then they told me I had to go do things like pick up ashtrays after the meeting. And I thought, me? Pick up an ashtray? You know, it wasn't that long before I was sleeping in a gutter somewhere, but now, you know, this great dignity of mine, you know, pick up an ashtray? Are you kidding me? But I went and did it. I did things that went against the grain. I did things I didn't want to do but had the willingness to do. And to me, there's a big difference between wanting to do something and having the willingness to do it. And they said to me, learn to live the steps. You can work on the steps all you want. You can read the steps all you want. You can take all the steps all you want. But you've got to learn to live the steps if you want to live sober. I was blessed by some of the people that I knew in AA. Not long before I got sober, there was a guy, and some of you folks that had been around back when I was young, and you were too, may have heard of him. His name was Father Dan Egan, and he was known as the Junkie Priest, and he was in New York. In the late 60s, they wrote a book about him, and they made a movie about his life. And there was a place up in Bear Mountain outside of New York City, up near West Point. It was called St. Christopher's Inn, and it was run by the Graymore and Franciscan Friars, and he was one of them, and it was a place where drunks could go, and they'd take them in and sober them up, and some of them even stayed there and became friars. I used to try to get there a lot, but I never made it, because I'd make it as far as Times Square in New York City, and somewhere I'd steal a drink, steal some money, get a drink, get a hooker on my arm, and off I'd be, you know. But I used to make these phone calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm sure nobody else here ever did anything like that. But, you know, and one of the calls that I made was down there to Graymore, and I got a hold of this guy, Father Dan, and it happened to be Dan Egan. And I was so full of despair, and this man literally saved my life by one thing that he said to me, and only one. And he kept saying, every time I'd get the poor man up at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know. But he always said the same thing to me. He said this, try to remember, son, that no matter what you've done to yourself, God still loves you. And to me, that's one of the best messages I can give to anybody in the world today. No matter what you've done to yourself, God still loves you. It saved my life. Maybe it'll save somebody else's. I listened to what these people told me. There was a guy, when I was 10 years sober, it was 1985. The man that was my sponsor at the time was... And I've had both men and women sponsors, and I sponsor both men and women. I know that's probably not real awfully popular with some people, but it's just the AA I was taught. His name was Joe C., and there was no AA in Boston in 1940, so he went down to New York City with a couple of other guys. They found Bill W., and they got sober. I asked him one time, we were talking, and I said to him, he was 45 years sober at the time, and I said, what is this spiritual part? I hear so much controversy. And he said, well, I think it's really simple. He said, the spiritual part of the disease is simply that when you drink alcohol, you go places, do things, and associate with people you normally wouldn't. And he pointed some things out to me in the big book. And I thought, that makes sense. I don't have to wrap my head around some twisted theology. And that's not knocking anybody's theology, okay? It's just that, for me, the best thing I can do in Alcoholics Anonymous is to keep it as simple as humanly possible. It's all that's worked for me, because I still have an alcoholic mind, you know? There's no way I would tell anybody on this earth that I, you know, some perfect being, that I'm some spiritual guru. I'm not. I'm just a guy that stays sober a day at a time, makes mistakes in life, and knows how to apologize today, which is something I didn't know how to do before. And because of AA, today I'm a person that knows how to take responsibility for myself, for my actions. When I'm wrong, promptly admit it. Well, admit it to who? Well, it began by admitting it to myself, that I can be wrong. I hurt people sometimes. And when I see it, I go and apologize because I was wrong. Yeah. I've never wanted to compete with anybody. I've never wanted to be better or smarter or brighter than anybody else. I just want to live a sober life, and AA gave me a way to do that. I've probably made every mistake you can humanly make in Alcoholics Anonymous, except for two. There's never been a single time when in the morning I haven't asked God, and I've never asked God to keep me sober, never once. I've always asked him, just please keep me away from the first drink today, because that's the one that'll get me drunk, and if I don't take it, I can't get drunk. And I've never failed to say thank you at night. Other than that, I've pretty much screwed the pooch in a lot of things and made a lot of mistakes, okay? And you know what? If I continue to live a little bit longer, I'm probably going to do the same thing again, because I'm still kind of a dog, and, you know, it's just the way it is. I didn't come here to get saintly or perfect or anything else. I came here to get sober and learn to live better and stop hurting people, and AA gave me that gift. Y'all want to go swimming? Give me a couple of minutes to break your microphone here. Damn near fell up the stairs a little while ago, so I might as well break the microphone. Somebody gave me this very early on in sobriety. It was written back in the 1940s, and if you don't mind, would you mind if I read it to you? It's a little bit long, but not very. It was written by a man named Fulton Osler. He was a playwright, a journalist. He wrote some novels, The Greatest Life Ever Lived, The Greatest Story Ever Told, and he was not an alcoholic, but he wrote this. He said, down at the very bottom of the social scale of Alcoholics Anonymous Society are the untouchables and the outcasts, all underprivileged and all known by one excoriating epithet, relatives. He says, I'm a relative. I know my place. I'm not complaining. But I hope no one will mind if I venture the plaintive confession that there are times, or many times, when I wish I had been an alcoholic. By that, I mean that I wish I were an AA member. The reason is that I consider the AA people the most charming in the world. What a hell of a thing to say about a bunch of ex-drunks. You know? Such is my considered opinion. As a journalist, it's been my fortune to meet many of the people who are considered charming. I number among my friends stars and lesser lights of stage and cinema. Now I'm up on a stage, so I probably would have fit in. Writers are my daily diet. I know the ladies and gentlemen of both political parties. I have been entertained in the White House. I have broken bread with kings, ministers, and ambassadors. And I say, after that catalog, which could be extended, that I would prefer an evening with my AA friends to any group of persons or any person I have indicated. What an amazing thing to say about drunks. I ask myself why I consider so charming these alcoholic caterpillars who have found their butterfly wings in Alcoholics Anonymous. There are more reasons than one, but I can name a few. The AA people are what they are, and they were what they were because they are sensitive, imaginative, possessed of a sense of humor and an awareness of universal truth. They're sensitive, which means they are hurt easily, and that helped them to become alcoholics. But when they found their restoration, they are still as sensitive as ever, responsive to beauty and truth and eager about the intangible glories of this life. That makes them charming companions. And they're possessed of a sense of universal truth that is often a new thing in their hearts. The fact that this at-one-ment with God's universe had never been awakened in them is sometimes the reason why they drank. The fact is, it was at last awakened. The fact that it was at last awakened is almost always the reason why they were restored to the good and simple way of life. I believe that without God, there is no AA. They're imaginative, and that helped to make them alcoholics. Some of them drank to flog their imaginations on to greater efforts. Others guzzled only to black out unendurable visions that rose in their imagination. But when they found their restoration, their imagination is responsive to new incantations, and their talks abound with color and light, and that makes them charming companions, too. They are possessed of a sense of humor. Even in their cups, they've been known to say damnable funny things. Often it was being forced to take seriously the little and mean things of life that made them seek escape in a bottle. But when they found their restoration, their sense of humor finds a blessed freedom, and they are able to reach a godlike state where they can laugh at themselves, the very height of self-conquest. Go to their meetings and listen to their laughter. At what are they laughing? At ghoulish memories over which weaker souls would cringe in useless remorse. And that makes them wonderful people to be with by candlelight. Stand with them when the meeting is over and listen as they say the Our Father. They found a power greater than themselves, which they diligently serve, and that gives a charm that has never been elsewhere on land and sea. It makes you know that God himself is really charming because AA people reflect his mercy and forgiveness. That, my friends, was written about you and me. And whenever I read that, I have to ask myself, how well do I live up to that? And some days, not so good. But a lot more days than not, a lot better than I once did. I am far from being the person that I would like to be in this world. Life hasn't always been kind to me. There's been a lot of losses, a lot of hurt in my sobriety. But I've never once had the desire to pick up a drink, and I've never had to. They asked me to speak here. I found that to be an honor. But there was a greater honor given to me in my life a long time ago, and that was because God himself honored me with the gift of sobriety. And I refuse today to dishonor him by not doing everything in my power to maintain that. Because if I do that, is that a moral problem? I think so. For me, at least, not for anyone else. And I never speak for anyone else. I also speak too much. You want to go swimming. I love you too. I don't know you. Not all of you. I may never meet some of you again. But when I stand here tonight, we're all one thing together. We're all the present of Alcoholics Anonymous. The one slight difference is that I'm Alcoholics Anonymous past, as well as its present. You're Alcoholics Anonymous future, as well as its present. And what an amazing thing God has given you to do. To say to a drunk, come up higher. I have something for you to do. I want you to go save lives. I want you to share your own humiliations and your own brokenness and your own story so that another person is broken, humiliated, lonely, sad, and disgusted with themselves as you are can understand that they're not alone and that you can provide them the solution just as it was provided to you. And I just think that that is just an absolutely amazing gift that how could I not be grateful for it? I'm sorry, I get a little emotional. I just love what I've been given. Wasn't deserved, wasn't earned. It was a gift freely given, and the only thing I can do is come to places like this and try to freely give it back. I love you. Thank you for being who you are, and I think you really are charming. We probably wouldn't do too good if we got drunk together. I don't think anybody would think we were very charming, but it's just a wonderful thing. And when I walk out of here tonight, what I see in all of your faces, what it gives me is a hope for the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know what this has done for me, and I don't ever want to let go. Thank you for listening to me.
That was amazing. Thank you, Shay. Now, if you guys don't mind helping clean up just a little bit, we're going to get things wrapped up here and head over to the Elks Pool. If you need the address,